What's up, everybody? You're listening to The Raven's Grove. I'm your host, Dahi, and today we're going to be looking at our long-running... We're going to be returning to our long-running segment, Warfare Through History. More specifically, we're going back to the Viking Age once again, and we're going to be talking about the Battle of Stamford Bridge, a battle that literally led to an event that changed the course of human history. Now, before we begin, this episode of The Raven's Grove features the following trigger warnings. Blood and gore, death mentions, battle war mentions, spear mentions, sword mentions, axe mentions, dismemberment mentions, wound mentions, and arrow mentions. So if any of those are in any way an issue for you, please give this episode a miss. Right, so to start things off, I'd like to address some common misconceptions about Viking culture and about Viking warfare. Now, if you've already listened to the first Warfare Through History episode, this will be very familiar to you, but please bear with me as, given the time between these two episodes and the subject of today's episode, I feel it's very important to reinforce these points. Firstly, the most obvious misconceptions. Vikings did not have horns on their helmets. Metal helmets were very rare and very expensive in the Viking era, and as such, many Vikings actually went into battle either without any head protection or wearing a simple cap made of fur and or leather. In addition, if you had horns on your helmet in battle, an enemy warrior could easily grab the horns and either throw you off balance or rip the helmet off your head, either of which would have been more than enough of an opportunity for them to kill you. Now, I'll admit, there is a distinct possibility of some example of horned headgear may have existed in the Viking era, but let me be very, very clear on this. If they did exist, and that's a very big if, then it would have been solely for use in religious rituals and ceremonies and not in battle. In fact, there's only been one complete Viking helmet that's ever been found in all of archaeology, and it did not have horns and helmets. The horns and helmets thing started with Wagner, but that's a story for another time. Now, the second myth I'd like to clear up is that the Vikings are all gigantic in stature. Let's take a look at some of the statistics for the average modern-day height of an adult man of European descent, shall we? Now, the average height for adult men in Denmark is 180.4 centimeters, which is 5'11". In Sweden, the average is 181.5 centimeters, 5'11.5". In Norway, it's 179.7 centimeters, again, 5'11" or so. And in Iceland, it's 181 centimeters, 5'11.5". By comparison, the average height of an adult man in Australia is about 175.6 centimeters, aka 5'9". And the height of an average white man in the US is 178 centimeters, 5'10". Now, you might be thinking, well, this is all very interesting, but what does it have to do with the Vikings? Well, according to www.skjaldin.com, that's spelled skjaldin.com, the Viking archaeological excavations on Viking-era graves in Scandinavia revealed that the average height for an adult man of Scandinavian descent in the Viking era, according to the grave sites, was approximately 172 centimeters, which is about 5'6". This negates the idea that the Vikings were huge mountains of muscle. Third is a stereotype that the Vikings dressed like Conan the Barbarian, by which I mean very little armor and basically a battle kilt or a loincloth, and that they were filthy. Now, this is a very wrong misconception. Firstly, the Norse culture and Norsemen were phenomenal traders and artists in all things relating to textiles. Viking clothes were often made of linen or wool, and were very often brightly dyed, usually in red, blue, or yellow, or a combination of all three colors. And as for the whole Vikings being filthy thing, when it comes to matters concerning personal grooming and appearance, you'd be hard-pressed to find a culture in Europe up until the middle of the 20th century that was so fastidious about being clean and looking their best. Seriously, I've done talks about this in Random Fact Dumps episodes on the Vikings, so give those a look if you're after more info. But the short version of this is, the Vikings were, by the standards of their time, they were actually considered to be very vain because of how much importance they put on cleanliness. It was a huge deal. So the final misconception I'd like to clear up is that the Vikings either used a two-handed sword or a double-headed battle axe. Now, I'm going to go on record here. I'm a big fan of the classic barbarian trope in fantasy fiction, but, well, quite frankly, the real world isn't fantasy. The sheer fact of the matter is that the most common weapon on the battlefield in the Viking era for an average raider was either a spear or an axe, not a sword. Swords were extremely expensive during the Viking era, due primarily to the level of expertise and the lengthy amount of time and materials needed to properly manufacture one. Now, to put this in perspective, Having a spear would be the equivalent of having a simple fixed gear bicycle today. It's not the flashiest nor the most luxurious method of getting around, but it'll get you to point A and point B and back again. Having an axe for combat would be the equivalent of having a sensible family saloon car or reasonably priced hatchback. Again, nothing fancy, but a definite upgrade over a spear. Having a sword? Well, that'd be the equivalent of having a top-of-the-line, exorbitantly expensive supercar made of an incredibly rare material, say like a Bugatti Veyron made of solid platinum. Everyone would notice you on the battlefield, but often you get a better performance out of it when it comes down to certain factors. The point is, swords were extremely rare in terms of grave goods and finds, and depending on the quality, they could be reasonable to the best swords we've found in Europe up until the Industrial Revolution, which is what Ulfbert swords are. I've done topics on those before. Go check them out. Ulfberts, in my opinion, are some of the best swords ever made. And yes, I'm including katanas in that rating. So, the other misconception about Viking weaponry is that the Vikings used huge double-headed battle axes. Now, I will admit, double-headed battle axes do actually exist. They are commonly used in cutting down trees and lumberjack circles. And they did exist in the ancient world. However, they were almost never used in actual combat, and they were not used in combat by the Vikings. The Vikings favored three distinct types of axes. You had the throwing axe, you had the Dane axe, and you had the Skegox. The throwing axe, as the name implies, is designed to be used as a ranged weapon, though it can be used in melee combat in emergencies, and as such, is pretty small, it's very light, and features a distinct bend in the shaft similar to that of a strung bow. Essentially, it's what you get if you combine a boomerang with an axe head on it, and you combine that with a tomahawk. It's a very small weapon. It's designed to be thrown with one hand, it's lethal in the right context, and it's designed to be a ranged combat weapon. While it still can be used in melee combat, it's not designed for that. The Dane axe, on the other hand, is a massive two-handed weapon with a large, very thin, single-headed blade. Basically, a Dane axe is like what you'd get if you put a chef's cleaver on a pole around 5 foot long, roughly 150 centimeters, and then you gave it to a very angry Viking. In combat, the Dane axe was used predominantly by the Berserkir, more on them later, and it was said to be able to split an unarmed man right down the middle, from his head to his groin. If having a throwing axe is like having a motorbike, a Dane axe is like having a full-on ex-military armored vehicle, like a decommissioned Humvee. It's large, it's powerful, and it sends a very clear do-not-mess-with-me vibe. Finally, we come to my personal favorite of the Viking axes, the Skegox. Now, if you're familiar with the TV show Vikings on SBS, or if you've seen the, quite frankly, amazing film The Northmen, then you've already seen Skegoxes in action. Ragnar Lothbrok's one-handed axe is a classic example of Skegox, as is the axe used in the beginning of the film by Prince Amleth in the film The Norseman. Skegoxes were wielded in one hand, usually with a shield in the other hand, but apart from with the Ulfethnard, but I'll get onto them later, and they had a distinctive beard to the blade. Now, this beard gives the Skegox its more common name, the bearded axe, and it also plays a pretty important function in combat. See, you can use a Skegox's beard to hook your opponent's shield rim to create an opening to attack them, you can use it to catch your opponent's weapon to disarm them, or even to hook your opponent themselves, like on the wrist or around the neck if you're close enough, to throw them off balance. Now, Skegoxes, like the Dane axes, are far, far lighter than most people expect. They have a very thin blade. See, most people, they see an axe like we have in the modern day, which is predominantly like a wood-splitting axe. They think that's the kind of axe that the Vikings had. The Vikings did have wood-splitting axes, I'm not denying that. But the key difference here is the weight and the design of the blade. Viking battle axes have extremely thin, very light blades. They're designed for speed and power in combat. They're basically like cleavers. Whereas a wood axe is designed to use weight and gravity in the strike. So it's a lot heavier, it's got a much broader blade. I'm not saying you can't use a wood axe to do damage, you definitely can, but what I'm saying is it's not designed for battle. Battle axes was explicitly designed to take a life, and they did that extremely well. Now, Skegoxes, if a Dane axe is like having an ex-military vehicle, Skegoxes are like the equivalent of having a pickup truck, like a Land Rover Defender, a Toyota Land Cruiser, a Ford F-150 Ranger. It's capable of nearly any task, it's reasonably affordable to a family, and it's also very much sending a very clear, don't mess with me or you will regret it type vibe. Now, as I mentioned earlier, there are certain types of warriors in Norse culture, and of them, it's the two distinct types of shamanic warriors I'm going to be talking about right now. You have the berserkir, singular is berserker, and the ulfhetnar, singular is ulfhetinn. Now, you might be wondering, what in all the name of the gods is a shamanic warrior? Well, shamanic warriors were a special type of warrior that were completely devoted to Odin, to a fanatical level. They were said to take on the spirits of two different animals in combat, and, well, you guys see how they were used. But there are a few main differences, more specifically, there are three main differences between the two groups. The berserkir and the ulfhetnar, as I said, they both took on the spirit of animals, but the berserkir chose the spirit of the bear, whereas ulfhetnar chose the spirit of the wolf. This is actually reflecting in the names. Berserker means bear shirt, whereas ulfhetnar means wolf shirt. So, yeah, interestingly, berserker is actually where we get the modern English term berserk, and I'll get to that in a second. The second difference is a style of combat. Both the berserker and the ulfhetnar were used as shock troops and special forces, but their approach to combat mirrored their chosen animals. The berserker favored two-handed weapons like the Dane axe and were more concerned with strength and powerful crushing attacks. The ulfhetnar, on the other hand, were dual-wielding specialists, using a combination of two one-handed weapons and preferred a more mobile style of combat, prioritizing speed and agility over pure crushing strength. The third difference is the physical size. As I mentioned before, the average Norse adult male during the Viking Age was about 172 centimeters, roughly 5'6". Your average ulfhetinn was anywhere from 170 centimeters, 5'7", to 182 centimeters, 6 foot in height, and was usually fairly lithe in build, akin to the rough body shape of a martial artist or a gymnast. They were not bulky people, is the point. Your average berserker was anything over 178 centimeters, that's 5'10". Anything over that, you're in berserker territory, and quite frankly, they were the tough guys. They were the built like tanks. If you've seen Game of Thrones, the character of the Mountain by Hafthor, he's actually a real-life example of a berserker. He's from Iceland. He is the example of what a berserker would look like to an average Viking man. So, the point here is that the ulfhetnar and the berserker were both much larger than average in terms of average body size, and they were specially trained in different types of combat. Now, it was said in the sagas that they could not be harmed by fire or steel, that they ran into battle with only a fur pelt to protect them, that they ran barefoot over sharp rocks without noticing, that they would bite the rims of their shields in a battle frenzy, and when they entered the Berserkanga frenzy, they could not tell friend from foe. Put simply, you point them in the right direction, you get the Helheim out of their way. Now, like I said, if you're familiar with the show Vikings, or if you've seen the film The Northmen, then you'll already have an example of what an ulfhetnar looks like. Ragnar, Björn, and the other Ragnarsons and Vikings are classic examples of ulfhetnar in combat, as is Prince Amleth, which is, to be honest, the most accurate depiction of that type of warrior I've ever seen in my entire life. They are dual-wielding specialists who move around a fair bit, and they favor agility and speed. Now, also from the show Vikings is a fantastic example of a classic berserker, Rollo, Ragnar's brother. Rollo is bigger than an average Viking by a very wide margin, and he uses a Dane axe in combat. In fact, we actually get to see Rollo go full berserker gang in the first episode of season 2. I won't spoil it for you, but let's just say it's both awesome and terrifying. Now, you might be wondering, why is he telling me all this? Well, simply put, the Battle of Stamford Bridge in 1066 CE, that's Common Era, I use that because it's a scientific way of saying AD. So, 1066 CE, Battle of Stamford Bridge, is considered by most scholars to be the effective end of the so-called Viking Age in Europe. You see, by this time in history, the worship of the Norse pantheon of deities like Odin, Thor, Freya, Loki, those guys, they had all but died out in the Viking homelands of Denmark, Sweden, Norway, Iceland, and the Faroe Islands, and the vast majority of those lands had actually been successfully Christianized. However, the Battle of Stamford Bridge was not a meek affair. It was not like some tiny little speed bump. If anything, it was proof that Norse pantheon's ideals were alive and kicking in the Vikings involved in the battle, and they went out fighting, believe me. But before we talk about the battle itself, we need to talk about the power struggle that led up to it. You see, in January of 1066 CE, the Saxon King of England, Edward the Confessor, he died. His death led to three separate claimants all vying for the throne of England. These three claimants were, you had Harald Godwinson, the Saxon from England, you had Harald Hardrada, the King of Norway, and William, Duke of Normandy. Harald Godwinson, being a Saxon born in England, laid claim to the throne and was crowned King of England by the Saxon lords, and this enraged both of the other two claimants, and unbeknownst to each other, they each prepared an invasion fleet to try and take the English throne by force. According to the St. Anglo-Saxon Chronicle Manuscript D, Harald Hardrada's force set out from Norway with 300 ships, but the authors of the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle do not appear to differentiate between warships and supply vessels. In King Harald's saga, the Icelandic chronicler Snorri Sturluson states that, and I'm quoting it directly here, it is said that King Harald had over 200 ships apart from supply ships and smaller craft, end quote. Combined with reinforcements picked up in Orkney, the main Norse base of operations in Scotland, the Norwegian army most likely numbered between 7,000 and 9,000 men. Arriving off the English coast in September, Harald Hardrada was joined by further forces recruited in Flanders and Scotland by Torstig Godwinson. Now, if the name Godwinson sounds familiar, that's actually for a good reason, because Torstig is actually the younger brother of Harald Godwinson, who had been elected king by the Vitenagemagot upon the death of Edward the Confessor, and he was not happy about this. He had been ousted from his position as Earl of Northumbria and was exiled in 1065. He had also launched a series of abortive attacks on England in the spring of 1066. So Torstig was allied with the Vikings. He thought it would be a good claim to gain power. Harald Hardrada, in and of himself, was actually considered to be the last great Viking in history. He was a captain of the Varangian Guard, who I've already talked about in an earlier episode. He was a ferocious leader in combat. Even though he was technically Christian, he worshipped the old gods in private. So, an absolutely phenomenal fighter, tactical genius. He knew exactly how to deploy his men to the best of their ability, and he had been seasoned in combat in service to the Byzantine Emperor. He was a very, very capable leader, is the point. Now, in the late summer of 1066, the invaders sailed up the Ouse River before advancing on York. And on 20th September, they defeated a northern English army led by Edwin, Earl of Mercia, and his brother Morcar, Earl of Northumbria, at the Battle of Fulford outside of York. Following this victory, they received the surrender of York. Having briefly occupied the sea and taken hostages and supplies from the city, they returned towards their ships at Rickall. They offered peace to the Northumbrians in exchange for their support for Hardrada's bid for the throne, and they demanded further hostages for the whole of Yorkshire. At this time, King Harald Godwinson was in southern England, anticipating an invasion from France by William, Duke of Normandy, who we already know is another contender for the English throne. I'll mention William more a bit later. Learning of the Norwegian invasion, Harald Godwinson headed north at top speed with his housecarls, the elite Saxon warriors making up the king's bodyguard, and with as many thanes, read lords, equivalent Viking term would be jarl, as he could muster, travelling at top speed both day and night, barely resting. He made the journey from London to Yorkshire, a distance of about 185 miles, 298 kilometres, in only 4 days, enabling him to take the Norwegians completely by surprise. And having left, the Northumbrians had been ordered to send the additional hostages and supplies to the Norwegians at Stamford Bridge, Harald hurried through York to attack them at the rendezvous on the 25th of September. Until the English army came into view, the invaders remained completely unaware of a presence anywhere in the vicinity. As to where the battle itself took place, manuscripts C, D, and E of the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle all mention Stamford Bridge by name. And manuscript C contains a passage which states, quote, came upon them beyond the bridge, end quote. Henry of Huntingdon mentions Stamford Bridge and describes the part of the battle being fought across the bridge, but the exact location of the battle site is not known for certain. Sources indicate that it took place along the Derwent River, a river where a wooden bridge crossed the water. There are indications of a meadow on the west side of the river and high ground on the eastern side. The original bridge, however, no longer exists, and no archaeological traces of it have ever been found. The traditional locating of part of the battle at Battle Flats is based on no contemporary references. Statements in the 18th century skeletons and weapons were found there have not been corroborated by any modern finds. At best, it's a folklorist decision. Now, basically, what happened in the battle was the Viking army resting on one side of the bridge, thinking the Saxons were a long way away. According to Norse scouts, they were at least 3 days away. Scouts were badly wrong. Saxon army comes into view, and the Viking army knew they were in an extremely bad position. You see, the Saxon army had between 10,500 and 15,000 footmen and 2,000 cavalry units at their disposal. The Viking army numbered between 9,000 and 11,000 men, of which 3,000 men were engaged late in the battle, and about 300 ships. As you can see, the Vikings were badly outnumbered by the Saxons, and in addition, the Saxon use of cavalry was a deciding factor, as the style of combat used by the Vikings was almost entirely based around combat on foot. They were not prepared for cavalry. However, there was a glimmer of hope for the Vikings. Stamford Bridge itself was a natural choke point, being narrow enough that only one soldier would be able to hold it off a much larger force alone. According to both sides' chroniclers, a lone berserker volunteered for the mission, allowing the Viking army to retreat to a more favorable position. Now, remember the different types of axes I talked about earlier? Well, this berserker was armed with a Dane axe, and by Heimdall's nine mothers did he use it. This one man, in the full berserk anger frenzy, managed to slay at least 40 Saxons before being undone, and not in the way you'd think. Knowing the full-on approach against such a intimidating and ferocious foe was tantamount to suicide, a Saxon soldier, very sneakily in my opinion, floated beneath the bridge and stabbed upwards from beneath with a spear. Mortally wounded, the lone berserker fell, but not before taking out at least 40 Saxons and fulfilling his mission of delaying the Saxon force long enough for the Viking army to get to a more favorable position. Sadly, this brave warrior's name was never recorded to history. The delay had allowed the bulk of the Norse army to form a shield wall to face English attack. Harold's army, the Saxon army, poured across the bridge, forming a line just short of the Norse army, locked shields, and charged. The battle went far beyond the bridge itself, and though it raged for hours, the Norse army's decision to leave their armor behind them to escape left them at a distinct disadvantage. Eventually, the Norse army began to fragment and fracture, with allowing English troops to force their way in and break up the Scandinavian shield wall. Completely outflanked, and with Hardrada killed by an arrow to his windpipe and Tostig slain, the Norwegian army disintegrated and was virtually annihilated. In the later stage of the battle, the Norwegians were reinforced by troops who had been guiding the ships of Rikal, led by Eystein Ore, Hardrada's prospective son-in-law. Some of his men were said to have collapsed and died from exhaustion upon reaching the battlefield. The remainder were fully armed for battle. The counterattack, described in the Norwegian tradition as Ore's Storm, briefly checked the English advance, but they were soon overwhelmed and Ore himself was slain. The Norwegian army was routed. As given in the chronicles, pursued by the English army, some of the fleeing Norsemen drowned while crossing rivers. So many of them died in an area so small that the field afterwards was said to have been still whitened by bleached bones, 50 years after the battle. However, even though it was a great victory for the Saxons, Harold and Godwinson's victory was short-lived. 3 days after the battle, on the 28th of September, a second invasion army led by William, Duke of Normandy, landed at Pevensey Bay, Sussex, on the south coast of England. Harold had to immediately turn his troops around and force march them southwards to intercept the Norman army. Less than 3 weeks after Stamford Bridge, on the 14th of October, 1066, the English army was decisively defeated in battle at Hastings, and King Harold Godwinson fell to an arrow in his eye at the Battle of Hastings, beginning the Norman conquest of England, a process facilitated by the heavy losses among the English military commanders. Put simply, if the Viking army had worn out the ranks and the energy of the Saxon army, the Battle of Hastings may have gone very differently, and history as we know it could be completely unrecognizable in the modern day. And yes, I will be talking about the Battle of Hastings another time, because William of Normandy became known as William the Conqueror. Anyway, that's all for today. Folks, thanks for listening to the Ravenscrove. I've been Nahi, you've been awesome. I'll talk to you next episode. See ya.